Welcome to week 8 of Stat 222, weeks 8 and week 9 upcoming. We're going to continue what we started last week, week 7, analysis of durations, introduction to survival analysis. And our lecture slides are as usual, 20lect8.pdf, linked on the webpage. And this audio I'll do in a couple parts. I'm doing this Tuesday morning, or at least starting it, and this will may be a process that goes over 2 days, depending on how the afternoon goes. So we are in week 8. The first page of the PDF is simply the web page. A couple of the sources we'll use is the Singer and Willett set of slides and data, especially for discrete time survival analysis, which they take more seriously than I do. So the survival analysis chapter in a handbook of statistical analysis using R. Going to page 2 of the PDF, we have a series of standard texts for survival analysis, Klapfleisch and Prentice, Klein and Mosbacher, and Terry Thurnau, one of our heroes, also has a extensive book. And there's also a book on interval sensor data, which is one of the things we'll introduce today. So those are some of your deep resources, just to have them available without having to get up. One item on PDF page 2 that I want to especially call your attention to is the partial posting I did of the course problem set. I said I would do that in the last lecture I mentioned, and I did do it over the weekend. To get you going, everything's due November 20th. I will add to this, say, approximately November 10th or so, the final problems. There's 3 problems posted in this partial posting, just to give you more time to work on that. And there's notes on the page that contains the problem. So I'd encourage you to take a look if you haven't already. PDF page 3 gets us to the week 8 protocol. And we have a number of topics, some which we go into more detail than others. We'll do the recidivism data to do a more extensive treatment of Cox regression. This is a parole, actual randomized trial, financial support and parole. And it's picked up in a number of places, including John Fox, and very nice set of slides from Lausanne, which is Swiss. Sometimes I say it's French, but it's Swiss. And then interval censoring, which is an important, I think, topic, not as widespread as right-censored data, which is mainly what survival analysis concentrates on. Then we have third is discrete time survival analysis, which I'll pitch is mostly should be considered interval censoring. Instead, discrete time survival analysis I regard as a legacy topic, mainly attractive because you can do it by logistic regression. So you don't have to do any survival analysis. And that it has a certain seductiveness. Do some background on renewal processes, on-off processes, and how survival analysis is a special case on that. We'll come back and do recurrent events, asthma, angina, time on task next week. A couple of mentions of design. My favorite package is no longer, but PowerServe Epi is a good package, and we have a review question on that, etc. And then as a side topic, parametric survival models. Instead of letting the baseline hazard just be not estimated non-parametrically, you can say, I know what the waiting time distribution or the survival function is, so I'm going to fit it. And maybe in some engineering examples, that is relevant. We'll look at ServReg and FlexServe briefly, and we have a review question on it, just to show you that exists. But probably not that common for many applications these days. So I have a set of review questions that kind of add on or fill in some of the things we introduce in the text. And we, of course, we have exercises for week 8, some extensive, and that gets us to PDF page 6, advertising what we're going to do next week, time-dependent covariates using the recidivism data, mixed effects models, just like there's an analogy to LMER for multi-center trials, and nested data, recurrent events, frailty models, and also, if we have time, joint modeling of longitudinal and time-to-event data, AIDS example, CD4 counts, and survival. So that gets us through PDF page 6. On PDF page 7, I'm just going to do a recap via a couple different sets of slides. I cut out some, but it's still pretty redundant, so we'll do that next. PDF page 7 begins a couple of passes at deep review, call it continuity if you want to be kind, just reminding us time to event data, how long till an event could be a death from a medical situation, or it could be time till toothache, time to exiting a maze. PDF page 8 defines the survival function, survival curve, probability of surviving until point T, or the time to event being at least T. And of course, this is a monotonically decreasing curve, or at least it is. So page 9 just reminds us of our life table examples, which we started last week. This was the example from Mark Feldman from the biology department, looking at human survival. And there still is a lot of research on this. When lifespan increases, is it because we prevented a lot of 30-year-olds from having accidental or even medical deaths, medically caused deaths? Or is it because old people are doing a little better? What does that curve look like? And they tried some robust percentile-based methods. I don't want to get into it. But if you're interested in those sorts of things, this is a wonderful detailed example. If long life is driven by decreases in old age disability by medical advances, there may be little or no change in the age pattern of old age deaths, but maybe there is. So that's what they tried to look at. And the optimistic highlight, one of the reasons I like this, is we find no evidence of an impending limit to human lifespan. It's just going to keep getting greater and greater, even though I'm pushing the upper edge of it. So that's a wonderful example. There's current research on these sorts of things. And just like we introduced, probability of deaths, ages past 65 for females and males on PDF page 10. So just to show you an example, this sort of thing is still being looked at. So PDF page 11, again, is deep review, reminding us of the Cox model, multiple regression on the log hazard. So the Cox model here, hazard is H, sometimes it's lambda, says we have a baseline hazard, H0 of T, and we leave that estimated non-parametrically, although at the end of today's lecture, we'll look at some parametric alternatives, which might be relevant in some physical science activities. And the proportional hazards assumption is that at two values of Z could be treatment and control, if Z is a binary indicator for treatment versus placebo. It's a constant ratio time, and if we put in an exponential, basically a regression model exponentiated. PDF page 12, standard version of the Cox model, baseline hazard, and then the part that depends on the covariate, it could be a group membership variable, and exponentiate the coefficient, hazard ratio corresponding to one unit change going, say, from placebo to treatment or treatment to placebo, whatever direction you have it coded, gives you the multiplicative effect on the hazard. And as hazard goes up, survival goes down. PDF page 13 just continues that, gives you the C log transformation, which we looked at Last week, briefly, as a way of looking at proportional hazards, although COX-CPH is Schoenfeld residuals is probably more precise, but that's the old-fashioned way of looking at it. And we'll look at that in interval censoring. We actually come back to C-log-log plots. PDF page 13, PDF page 14, just another version of this. Here, hazards are lambda. We have the hazard, cumulative hazard, cumulative distribution of first events, and survival function, which is our standard, which is also can be written in terms of the cumulative hazard. That's PDF page 14. Again, just additional slides, deep review. And then we have the Cox proportional hazards model, again, showing that the ratio is constant over time when things are working out right, where we have the unspecified baseline hazard is the only time dependence. And that's the basis of Cox regression. And we can look for violations of that and try to fix them. And that's what we did last week. PDF page 16 continues on. PDF page 16, which is from Terry Thurnow, a couple of detailed comments that are good background. The way things are computed in Cox regression, you can just use the censoring. You use the data you have and then continue on. The idea why things are exponentiated and done multiplicatively, just like for count models where it's multiplicative, you want to avoid negative death rates or counts going down. And there's a comment here, it's useful at the end. The accelerated failure time model, which is given at the end, is probably not a good alternative to Cox regression. That's the final comment on PDF page 16. So these are just some asides. And a good point we will come back to, we did a little bit, baseline hazard is arbitrary. We can look at it, we can plot it, but not necessarily a point of interest, just like the analog is to intercepts in a multiple regression or analysis covariance, say. You're not really that concerned about the intercept, you're concerned about the efficiency of the treatment variable or other important predictors. PDF page 18 just reviews again Cox regression. This was our handout, and so I'll leave that just here as convenient. Another comment on the baseline hazard. You can plot that, and we do at the mean of the value of the covariates, and that's what we do for baseline hazard. And we have a little bit on base has. You can get it from the survival package. Base has. And then the Cox regression PDF page 20. Again, just reviewing. We have the same things we said before. The hazard ratio is exponentiated. And the ratio of two conditional probabilities, XB. And we want to estimate that and get a confidence interval for it. Effect on the hazard ratio. So for real overkill, starting on PDF page 21, I slipped in a number of the introductory slides from this very nice treatment from Lausanne, Swiss. So I wanted to put that in front of you. It's linked and available, and we use it a couple places in this lecture and last for some of the details of survival analysis and the recidivism example. And we'll see that they do some very nice R code, especially that I want to give them credit for rather than me slipping it in review problems. So PDF 21 is just the slide, and then survival analysis, time to events. Time to event data takes different names. PDF page 23, hazard function gives a nice write out, and then hazard in terms of the survival function, and those basic relations which we've seen in one form or another. PDF page 24 just redefines hazard is lambda, survival is S, T is time until event, time until death, and observe covariate, months of unemployment, that's a good one. How long, when someone is unemployed, how long do they get reemployed? Mike Biocchi did a great study on whether smokers have a different survival curve than non-smokers, which is we use in the observational studies course. So you could have a bunch of covariates And then we have a survival curve, how long it takes to get reemployed. And this could be an on-off process or a one-time thing. And then proportional hazards model is what we've said it is, baseline hazard function, which we usually leave unanalyzed. And then we care about what's the effect on hazard and therefore survival of Z having different values, the covariate. And it could be more than one covariate. It could be a treatment group indicator. And modeling the baseline function, they do some things. Exponential or Weibull, our parametric models, will do that at section 6, I believe, of this lecture. That's a strong structure to the data. We don't really have often a reason for it, but we'll look at parametric survival analysis, which is modeling the baseline hazard parametrically. Then leaving the baseline hazard arbitrary, take any form, non-parametric maximum likelihood, and this is the Cox proportional hazards model. No making no arbitrary or incorrect assumptions. That's where we are. That's where I left you last week. Okay, there's a whole lot. And then we also looked at for the heroin example, where we had a violation of proportional hazards that could be accounted for by different baseline hazards for the two clinics. We're going to come into another situation where we may want to stratify in the recidivism data. And basically, each strata has a different baseline hazard, but the same regression relation. Multicenter trials, such as the two clinics, we're going to break up age, different age strata, have the same e to the x beta values, but different baseline hazards to deal with a clear proportional hazards violation. That's one of the common things to do, so reminding you of that. And we did that with Clinic Zero. PDF page 30 is just a recap of what we did at the end of last lecture. We looked at Clinic 1 versus Clinic 2, saw a strong effect, but when we tried to test proportional hazards by Cox ZPH, you can see it blew up on us. Highly significant that there was a time trend, and the plot showed it also. So one way of dealing with that, since it's a multi-center trial, is stratify in the clinics and then say the regression relation between prison and dose and survival is the same within each clinic, but the clinics have different baseline hazards. And that's what we did with Cox-Hearn stratified there. And therefore, then that took care of our proportional hazards problem. Cox CPH behaves. And that was our result for the heroin data. PDF page 31 gets us to our new example. Here we have something new. Okay, now on PDF page 31, we actually have some new material. Whether the deep review was useful or not, we're starting new with a new example. And this is item 1. Of our class topics, the recidivism data. We have a designed experiment, 432 male prisoners with random assignment based on the FIN variable, individual received financial aid after release from prison. And the outcome is whether how long you go, time to event is how long you go before rearrest. And you hope a lot of people are censored, they go 52 weeks, the full 52 weeks without an arrest. So we don't know what their time to arrest is. We just know it's at least 52 weeks. And week is, of course, the indicator first arrest after release or censoring time, which would be 52. We have additional information on each individual, their age, which may well matter, young repeat offenders versus old ones, a race variable, work experience, married at the time of release, released on parole or not, you could be completed your sentence or on parole, and number of prior convictions, which might be interesting, whether it's a first-time offender or not, and education, which is an ordered categorical variable, which you might treat as a numerical variable. You could do it either way. what we are setting aside for week 9 is the time-dependent covariate. That'll be something new in week 9, where it's employment each week, which will lag for a week. That may be the biggest indicator of whether you do reoffend if you need the money. After all, as the song says by Sonny Curtis, I needed money because I had none. I fought the law and the law won. The employment variable may be one of the more important predictors. We'll do without this week and we'll add it in next week and see if that helps us. So the data are linked in various places as indicated on the webpage. We're going to read it in, take a look at it, and do some Cox regression. PDF page 32 shows you that the Lausanne group also does it, and they have the reference, money, work, and crime, 432 male prisoners given financial aid, half did not want to see if allowing financial aid after release from prison decreases recidivism rate, i.e. Increases the survival curve, decreases the hazard. So we read it in, and we have it in our class example. We have my Ragosa R session. We also have John Fox's tutorials and his SOCH 761 class notes where it's done. This is a common example, and also the Lausanne group does it. So we have lots of versions of the same analysis, and we do the same things, and that's quite useful. PDF page 33 now just has the variables. Arrest is our outcome, fin is our experimental variable, and we have our number of covariates, which may be helpful in increasing precision. So we have an ASCII post here on PDF page 34 is my start on the recidivism data back then. So I read it in from one of the various sites. Dimension 432 people. I have 62 variables, 62 columns, because there's all the employment variables. And below that, I printed off the first 12 columns. And you can see the rest is the employment variables. Some people were employed week one, not employed. So we have a week, which is our time to event, arrest, that's our indicator. So you can see a lot of censored data, 52, 52, 52, 52 for 4, 5, and 6, but 1, 2, and 3 are events, and we have their age, race, etc. So let's just do a simple SERVDIF, i.e. Kaplan-Meier, and we do that. And interestingly, we have serve week and arrest. That's our survival object, just using the fin variable. So we're just doing a two-sample t-test, Kaplan-Meier, and we're right on the edge, p.0501, no stars, no joy. And if we do a Cox regression version of it, of course, we get the same thing, just a little greater. We could try an exact test. It won't help us. If we can improve precision a little bit, this is a randomized experiment, by putting in what is we'll call the full Cox model, it's what all the examples do. Then if we put it in by our Cox regression, boy oh boy, fin is now just significant. Of course, as we've seen, there's more to say about both diagnostics for this model and interpretation. So on PDF page 35, let's turn to John Fox's Sociology 761 lecture notes. And he gets the same on the top frame of PDF page 35. We see that he gets the same results we did in our R session for Finn, etc. And then it's useful to look at some of his comments. Can hear from him rather than not. Getting financial aid decreases the hazard of rearrest, while an additional prior incarceration increases the hazard. So, and let's see how much, of course, that's the relevant idea, understanding the magnitude of the effect. as before, we look at the exponentiated coefficients, PDF page 36. So for the experimental variable, moving from non-financial aid to financial aid decreases the hazard proportionately about a third. That is, it's about 0.684 as large. 31%, almost a third. So that's pretty good, even though it's just marginally significant, because we have a certain amount of imprecision. Even though we had a pretty large sample size, you'd think we'd get more precision, but survival analysis depends on events, not just the total sample, and that's what makes this relatively imprecise, as we'll see for a confidence interval for multiplicative factor. Prior conviction also increases the hazard of rearrest about 10% for every rearrest. So that's an interesting quantitative variable. And so what we have on PDF page 37, just to show, we have fin coefficient 0.369, exponentiate 0.69, standard error, and the lower and upper confidence intervals from the Cox 2 was just including 1. When we go to the real Cox regression using, well, the full Cox regression, the full Cox model, we get, and what we were calling the full Cox model, and there's an unfortunate page break here, PDF page 37, we get that confidence interval that just included 1 when we didn't use any covariates, to go from 0.47 to 0.996 in the full Cox model. That's our issue with statistical significance. Confidence interval is always more informative, but it's pretty wide on the multiplicative effect on hazard, even though we have a relatively large sample. That'll come back to our power calculations later on. So that's PDF page 37 plus continuation. We also show you Lausanne also does it, gets the same result I do on PDF page 38. Covariates age and prio. Fin is the one we're interested in. The reason to show you Lausanne is they have such nice plots and the R code, and even showing you can, if you work a little bit at it, get nice labels and nice plots. So plot surfeit of the model will do it, and you get nice labels. And this is at the mean values of the covariates. What they do further in PDF page 40 is they want to see different survival curves for FIN1 and FIN0. And you have to break up the data, stratify it. And so there's nice little data manipulation there. And you get perhaps a useful plot for blue is the treatment group, red is the control group, and you can see the survival curves is a good deal of overlap there in the confidence intervals, and that's why it's hard to detect the effect of FIN with the amount of data we have. That's PDF page 41. That's why I included their treatment. They did a bunch of plots that are nice to see. Okay, then, and then finally on PDF page 42, we get to the continuation of the broken page break of the Maud Allison, and we get to see the coefficients and their confidence intervals. PDF page 42, top frame, and I want to call your attention to then checking proportional hazards, or our most global check, Cox CPH. Lausanne has the plots later on, so I didn't put them here, but you can see we got problems with age and work experience causing us to strongly reject global, so this wouldn't pass muster for meeting proportional hazards. And so we're going to have to do something about that. One of the things I do is take a look at age. And you can see there's a pretty wide range on age, 17 to 44, and the 44-year-olds may behave quite differently than the 17-year-olds. So I do a little stratification, forming a couple groups, three groups, about equal size almost, 17 to 21, 21 to 26, 26 to 44. So I'm going to do a stratification on age to try to help the proportional hazards, assuming that each age group has a different baseline hazard, but the effect of financial aid and other covariates were the same within each age group. And I also then did just a the old-fashioned C-log log plot, which is shown on the next PDF page, for looking at these three ages to see whether you get parallel. Doesn't look so bad, but test shows it's strong. I also played around with the baseline hazard and survival curves at the mean value of covariates, like Lausanne did, and then played around with Schoenfeld residuals. We can just do a plot ZPH. I showed you how to create it yourself by getting the Schoenfeld residuals from exactly the model. Those are all asides. You could fit with a Lewis smoother. So that's how you create your Cox.zph plots all by yourself, or you can just say plot Cox.zph. So next up is just showing the results, PDF page 43. There's my C-log log, which I don't normally do, but I did it here. Here's the survival curve at average covariates, pooling the two groups. That's, it's more interesting to look at the groups separately, but they aren't that different. You get a survival curve. And then you can plot ZPH, or you can do them yourself. So now on PDF page 45, I'm actually going to do the stratification. So mod Alice and stratified, PDH page 45 from the Rugosa R session, is instead of including age as a covariate, I'm doing a stratification on the three groups. Let's see if that helps us enough with Cox ZPH. Finn comes up quite strong. Work experience is no longer significant, which is quite interesting. There must have been some confounding with age there, and we play around with that in one of the review questions. So here we have, and then our Cox ZPH test is just enough to make global non-sig, but work experience is still a problem. Here we have it here. Even though it's not a significant predictor, it's significant contribution to violation of proportional hazards. This is enough so that maybe this model is acceptable. We try a review question where we just drop work experience. Finn is significant in this model, so the investigators are less unhappy. But we'd have to say we're kind of okay, not great. We'd like to know that. So maybe we drop out work experience, or maybe when we go to the full model with the time-dependent model, things look a little different. So stratifying on age definitely helped. Work experience is still a problem with proportional hazards. But we held up with our experimental comparison. So that's PDF page 45. So that's a partial thing, but we're going to wait till we get to the using the employment data. That might help us a whole lot. So back to Lausanne, PDF page 46, slide we've seen before, just the details on Schoenfeld, just showing you what a nice job they do. And so they came along. What they did was slightly different, which isn't what I do, but what many people do. After they fit the full model, they fit a second reduced model just using the statistically significant predictors. Age is a bit of a problem for Cox ZPH, even in this reduced model, which doesn't have work experience in it. It does have prior. By dropping work experience because it wasn't significant, which is a rule some people follow, age is your only real issue with CoxZPH, but you can see you don't get a significant difference for Finn because you dropped all the covariates that were perhaps helping you. So maybe that's not such a good strategy, although you don't play around to get significance by using less covariates arbitrarily. You do cut down on precision. So here were the Schoenfeld residuals. You can see age is a problem for this reduced model. So they do a stratification on age. And you can see age category. They did a couple of different categories. They formed less than 19, 19 to 25, 25 to 30, greater than 30. I only did three. It's arbitrary what you do. Here, then the treatment variable is not significant, but CoxCPH is happy, just like we saw when we stratified on age, PDF page 50. So it's different approaches. I don't see why you drop out those covariates, but WEX, of course, is a CoxCPH problem. And then they play around with the baseline hazard and a few other cumulative hazard functions for each of the age strata. It's nice to be able to see how to do that. So that concludes our first pass on these recidivism data. We'll come back next week, look at the time dependent. We look at it again in the review questions. We'll try to get a comprehensive view of whether financial incentives help with parole. You can see it's quite not quite significant, but a third decrease in recidivism would be quite a good effect if you could pin it down more accurately. So that's where we'll leave it, and we'll come back and start interval sampling or interval censoring in part B of the audio.